Chapter 11. At the appointed time I returned to Miss Havisham's, and my hesitating ring at the gate brought out Estella. She locked it, after admitting me as she had done before, and again preceded me into the dark passage where her candle stood. She took no notice of me until she had the candle in her hand, when she looked over her shoulder superciliously, saying, "You are to come this way today," and took me to quite another part of the house. The passage was a long one, and seemed to pervade the whole square basement of the manor-house. We traversed but one side of the square, however, and at the end of it she stopped and put her candle down and opened a door. Here the daylight reappeared, and I found myself in a small paved courtyard, the opposite side of which was formed by a detached dwelling-house that looked as if it had once belonged to the manager or head clerk of the extinct brewery. There was a clock in the outer wall of this house. Like the clock in Miss Havisham's room, and like Miss Havisham's watch, it had stopped at 9:20. We went in at the door, which stood open, and into a gloomy room with a low ceiling on the ground floor at the back. There was some company in the room, and Estella said to me as she joined it, "You are to go and stand there, boy, till you are wanted." There, being the window, I crossed to it and stood there, in a very uncomfortable state of mind, looking out. It opened to the ground and looked into a most miserable corner of the neglected garden, upon a rank ruin of cabbage stalks and one box tree that had been clipped round long ago like a pudding, and had a new growth at the top of it, out of shape and of a different colour, as if that part of the pudding had stuck to the saucepan and got burnt. This was my homely thought as I contemplated the box tree. There had been some light snow overnight, and it lay nowhere else, to my knowledge. But it had not quite melted from the cold shadow of this bit of garden, and the wind caught it up in little eddies and threw it at the window, as if it pelted me for coming there. I divined that my coming had stopped conversation in the room, and that its other occupants were looking at me. I could see nothing of the room except the shining of the fire in the window-glass, but I stiffened in all my joints with the consciousness that I was under close inspection. There were three ladies in the room, and one gentleman. Before I had been standing at the window 5 minutes, they somehow conveyed to me that they were all toadies and humbugs, but that each of them pretended not to know that the others were toadies and humbugs, because the admission that he or she did know it would have made him or her out to be a toady and humbug. They all had a listless and dreary air of waiting somebody's pleasure, and the most talkative of the ladies had to speak quite rigidly to repress a yawn. This lady, whose name was Camilla, very much reminded me of my sister, with the difference that she was older, and, as I found when I caught sight of her, of a blunter cast of features. Indeed, when I knew her better, I began to think it was a mercy she had any features at all, so very blank and high was the dead wall of her face.
"Poor dear soul," said this lady,
with an abruptness of manner quite my sister's.
"Nobody's enemy but his own."
"It would be much more commendable to be somebody else's enemy," said the gentleman. "Far more natural."
"Cousin Raymond," observed another lady, "we are to love our neighbour."
"Sarah Pocket," returned Cousin Raymond, "if a man is not his own neighbour, who is?"
Miss Pocket laughed, and Camilla laughed, and said, checking a yawn,
"The idea!"
But I thought they seemed to think it rather a good idea, too. The other lady, who had not spoken yet, said gravely and emphatically,
"Very true." "Poor soul,"
Camilla presently went on. I knew they had all been looking at me in the meantime.
"He is so very strange. Would anyone believe that when Tom's wife died, he actually could not be induced to see the importance of the children's having the deepest of trimmings to their mourning? Good Lord! Says he, Camilla, what can it signify so long as the poor bereaved little things are in black? So like Matthew. The idea!"
"Good points in him, good points in him," said Cousin Raymond. "Heaven forbid I should deny good points in him. But he never had, and he never will have, any sense of the proprieties."
"You know I was obliged," said Camilla. "I was obliged to be firm. I said, it will not do for the credit of the family. I told him that without deep trimmings the family was disgraced. I cried about it from breakfast till dinner. I injured my digestion. And at last he flung out in his violent way and said with a D, "Then do as you like." Thank goodness it will always be a consolation to me to know that I instantly went out in a pouring rain and bought the things.
"He paid for them, did he not?" asked Estella.
"It's not the question, my dear child, who paid for them," returned Camilla. "I bought them, and I shall often think of that with peace when I wake up in the night."
The ringing of a distant bell, combined with the echoing of some cry or call along the passage by which I had come, interrupted the conversation and caused Estella to say to me,
"Now, boy."
On my turning round, they all looked at me with the utmost contempt, and as I went out I heard Sarah Pocket say,
"Well, I'm sure. What next?"
And Camilla add with indignation,
"Was there ever such a fancy? The idea!"
As we were going with our candle along the dark passage, Estella stopped all of a sudden, and facing round, said in her taunting manner, with her face quite close to mine,
"Well?"
"Well, miss,"
I answered, almost falling over her and checking myself. She stood looking at me, and of course I stood looking at her.
"Am I pretty?"
"Yes, I think you are very pretty."
"Am I insulting?"
"Not so much so as you were last time," said I.
"Not so much so?"
"No."
She fired when she asked the last question, and she slapped my face with such force as she had when I answered it.
"Now,"
said she,
"you little coarse monster, what do you think of me now?"
"I shall not tell you."
"Because you are going to tell upstairs. Is that it?"
"No," said I, "that's not it."
"Why don't you cry again, you little wretch?"
"Because I'll never cry for you again," said I,
which was, I suppose, as false a declaration as ever was made. For I was inwardly crying for her then, and I know what I know of the pain she cost me afterwards. We went on our way upstairs after this episode, and as we were going up we met a gentleman groping his way down.
"Whom have we here?"
asked the gentleman, stopping and looking at me.
"A boy,"
said Estella. He was a burly man of an exceedingly dark complexion, with an exceedingly large head and a corresponding large hand. He took my chin in his large hand and turned up my face to have a look at me by the light of the candle. He was prematurely bald on the top of his head and had bushy black eyebrows that wouldn't lie down but stood up, bristling. His eyes were set very deep in his head and were disagreeably sharp and suspicious. He had a large watch-chain and strong black dots where his beard and whiskers would have been if he had let them. He was nothing to me, and I could have had no foresight then that he ever would be anything to me, but it happened that I had this opportunity of observing him well.
"Boy of the neighbourhood, eh?"
said he.
"Yes, sir,"
said I.
"How do you come here?"
"Miss Havisham sent for me, sir," I explained.
"Well, behave yourself. I have a pretty large experience of boys, and you're a bad set of fellows. Now mind,"
said he, biting the side of his great forefinger as he frowned at me,
"you behave yourself."
With those words he released me, which I was glad of, for his hand smelt of scented soap, and went his way downstairs. I wondered whether he could be a doctor. But no, I thought. He couldn't be a doctor, or he would have a quieter and more persuasive manner. There was not much time to consider the subject, for we were soon in Miss Havisham's room, where she and everything else were just as I had left them. Estella left me standing near the door, and I stood there until Miss Havisham cast her eyes upon me from the dressing-table.
"So," she said, without being startled or surprised, "the days have worn away, have they?"
"Yes, ma'am. Today's—"
"There, there, there,"
with the impatient movement of her fingers.
"I don't want to know. Are you ready to play?" I was obliged to answer in some confusion.
"I don't think I am, ma'am."
"Not at cards again?"
she demanded, with a searching look.
"Yes, ma'am. I could do that if I was wanted. Since this house strikes you old and grave, boy," said Miss Havisham impatiently, "and you are unwilling to play, are you willing to work?"
I could answer this inquiry with a better heart than I had been able to find for the other question, and I said I was quite willing.
"Then go into that opposite room," she said, pointing at the door behind me with her withered hand, "and wait there till I come."
I crossed the staircase landing and entered the room she indicated. From that room, too, the daylight was completely excluded, and it had an airless smell that was oppressive. A fire had been lately kindled in the damp, old-fashioned grate, and it was more disposed to go out than to burn up, and the reluctant smoke which hung in the room seemed colder than the clearer air, like our own marsh mist. Certain wintry branches of candles on the high chimney-piece faintly lighted the chamber, or, it would be more expressive to say, faintly troubled its darkness. It was spacious, and I dare say had once been handsome, but every discernible thing in it was covered with dust and mould, and dropping to pieces. The most prominent object was a long table with a tablecloth spread on it, as if a feast had been in preparation when the house and the clocks all stopped together. An épergne, or centrepiece of some kind, was in the middle of this cloth. It was so heavily overhung with cobwebs that its form was quite undistinguishable, and as I looked along the yellow expanse out of which I remember its seeming to grow like a black fungus, I saw speckled-legged spiders with blotchy bodies running home to it and running out from it, as if some circumstances of the greatest public importance had just transpired in the spider community. I heard the mice, too, rattling behind the panels, as if the same occurrence were important to their interests. But the black beetles took no notice of the agitation and groped about the hearth in a ponderous, elderly way, as if they were short-sighted and hard of hearing and not on terms with one another. These crawling things had fascinated my attention, and I was watching them from a distance when Miss Havisham laid a hand upon my shoulder. In her other hand she had a crutch-headed stick on which she leaned, and she looked like the witch of the place.
"This," said she, pointing to the long table with her stick, "is where I will be laid when I am dead. They shall come and look at me here."
With some vague misgiving that she might get upon the table then and there and die at once, the complete realization of the ghastly waxwork at the fair, I shrank under her touch.
"What do you think that is?"
she asked me, again pointing with her stick.
"That? Where those cobwebs are?"
"I can't guess what it is, ma'am."
"It's a great cake. A bride cake. Mine."
She looked all round the room in a glaring manner, and then said, leaning on me while her hand twitched my shoulder,
"Come, come, come. Walk me, walk me."
I made out from this that the work I had to do was to walk Miss Havisham round and round the room. Accordingly, I started at once, and she leaned upon my shoulder, and we went away at a pace that might have been an imitation, founded on my first impulse under that roof, of Mr. Pumblechook's chaise cart. She was not physically strong, and after a little time said,
"Slower."
Still, we went at an impatient, fitful speed, and as we went, she twitched the hand upon my shoulder and worked her mouth, and led me to believe that we were going fast, because her thoughts went fast. After a while she said,
"Call Estella."
So I went out on the landing and roared that name as I had done on the previous occasion. When her light appeared I returned to Miss Havisham, and we started away again, round and round the room. If only Estella had come to be a spectator of our proceedings I should have felt sufficiently discontented. But as she brought with her the three ladies and the gentleman whom I had seen below, I didn't know what to do. In my politeness I would have stopped, but Miss Havisham twitched my shoulder and we posted on, with a shame-faced consciousness on my part that they would think it was all my doing.
"Dear Miss Havisham,"
said Miss Sarah Pocket.
"How well you look!"
"I do not," returned Miss Havisham. "I am yellow skin and bone."
Camilla brightened when Miss Pocket met with this rebuff, and she murmured as she plaintively contemplated Miss Havisham,
"Poor dear soul! Certainly not to be expected to look well, poor thing. The idea!"
"And how are you?" said Miss Havisham to Camilla. As we were close to Camilla then, I would have stopped, as a matter of course, only Miss Havisham wouldn't stop. We swept on, and I felt that I was highly obnoxious to Camilla.
"Thank you, Miss Havisham," she returned. "I am as well as can be expected."
"Why, what's the matter with you?"
asked Miss Havisham with exceeding sharpness.
"Nothing worth mentioning," replied Camilla. "I don't wish to make a display of my feelings, but I have habitually thought of you more in the night than I am quite equal to." "Then don't think of me," retorted Miss Havisham. "Very easily said," remarked Camilla, amiably repressing a sob, while a hitch came into her upper lip and her tears overflowed.
"Raymond is a witness what ginger and sal volatile I am obliged to take in the night. Raymond is a witness what nervous jerkings I have in my legs. Chokings and nervous jerkings, however, are nothing new to me when I think with anxiety of those I love. If I could be less affectionate and sensitive, I should have a better digestion and an iron set of nerves. I am sure I wish it could be so. But as to not thinking of you in the night, the idea!"
Here a burst of tears. The Raymond referred to, I understood to be the gentleman present, and him I understood to be Mr. Camilla. He came to the rescue at this point, and said in a consolatory and complimentary voice, "Camilla, my dear, it is well known that your family feelings are gradually undermining you to the extent of making one of your legs shorter than the other."
"I am not aware," observed the grave lady, whose voice I had heard but once, "that to think of any person is to make a great claim upon that person, my dear."
Miss Sarah Pocket, whom I now saw to be a little dry, brown, corrugated old woman, with a small face that might have been made of walnut shells, and a large mouth like a cat's without the whiskers, supported this position by saying,
"No, indeed, my dear. Hem."
"Thinking is easy enough," said the grave lady.
"What is easier, you know?"
assented Miss Sarah Pocket.
"Oh, yes, yes,"
cried Camilla, whose fermenting feelings appeared to rise from her legs to her bosom.
"It's all very true. It's a weakness to be so affectionate, but I can't help it. No doubt my health would be much better if it was otherwise. Still, I wouldn't change my disposition if I could. It's the cause of much suffering, but it's a consolation to know I possess it when I wake up in the night."
Here another burst of feeling. Miss Havisham and I had never stopped all this time, but kept going round and round the room, now brushing against the skirts of the visitors, now giving them the whole length of the dismal chamber.
"There's Matthew," said Camilla. "Never mixing with any natural ties, never coming here to see how Miss Havisham is. I have taken to the sofa with my staylace cut, and have lain there hours insensible, with my head over the side and my hair all down and my feet I don't know where."
"Much higher than your head, my love," said Mr. Camilla.
"I have gone off into that state hours and hours on account of Matthew's strange and inexplicable conduct, and nobody has thanked me."
"Really, I must say I should think not,"
interposed the grave lady.
"You see, my dear,"
added Miss Sarah Pocket, a blandly vicious personage,
"the question to put to yourself is, who did you expect to thank you, my love?" "Without expecting any thanks, or anything of the sort," resumed Camilla, "I have remained in that state hours and hours, and Raymond is a witness of the extent to which I have choked, and what the total inefficacy of ginger has been. and I have been heard at the pianoforte tuners across the street, where the poor mistaken children have even supposed it to be pigeons cooing at a distance. And now, to be told!'
Here Camilla put her hand to her throat, and began to be quite chemical as to the formation of new combinations there. When this same Matthew was mentioned, Miss Havisham stopped me and herself, and stood looking at the speaker. This change had a great influence in bringing Camilla's chemistry to a sudden end.
"Matthew will come and see me at last," said Miss Havisham sternly, "when I am laid on that table. That will be his place. There," striking the table with her stick, "at my head. And yours will be there. And your husband's there. And Sarah Pocket's there. And Georgiana's there. Now you all know where to take your stations when you come to feast upon me. And now go."
At the mention of each name, she had struck the table with her stick in a new place. She now said, "Walk me, walk me." And we went on again.
"I suppose there's nothing to be done," exclaimed Camilla, "but comply and depart. It's something to have seen the object of one's love and duty for even so short a time. I shall think of it with a melancholy satisfaction when I wake up in the night. I wish Matthew could have that comfort, but he sets it at defiance. I am determined not to make a display of my feelings, but it's very hard to be told one wants to feast on one's relations as if one was a giant, and be told to go. The bare idea!"
Mr. Camilla interposing, as Mrs. Camilla laid her hand upon her heaving bosom, that lady assumed an unnatural fortitude of manner which I supposed to be expressive of an intention to drop and choke when out of view, and kissing her hand to Miss Havisham was escorted forth. Sarah Pocket and Georgiana contended who should remain last. But Sarah was too knowing to be outdone, and ambled round Georgiana with that artful slipperiness that the latter was obliged to take precedence. Sarah Pocket then made her separate effect of departing with, "Bless you, Miss Havisham, dear," and with a smile of forgiving pity on her walnut-shell countenance for the weakness of the rest. While Estella was away lighting them down, Miss Havisham still walked with her hand on my shoulder, but more and more slowly. At last she stopped before the fire, and said, after muttering and looking at it some seconds,
"This is my birthday, Pip."
I was going to wish her many happy returns, when she lifted her stick.
"I don't suffer it to be spoken of. I don't suffer those who were here just now, or anyone to speak of it. They come here on the day, but they dare not refer to it."
Of course I made no further effort to refer to it.
"On this day of the year, long before you were born, this heap of decay," stabbing with her crutched stick at the pile of cobwebs on the table, but not touching it, "was brought here. It and I have worn away together. The mice have gnawed at it, and sharper teeth than teeth of mice have gnawed at me."
She held the head of her stick against her heart as she stood looking at the table. She in her once white dress, all yellow and withered. The once white cloth, all yellow and withered. Everything around, in a state to crumble under a touch.
"When the ruin is complete," said she, with a ghastly look, "and when they lay me dead, in my bride's dress, on the bride's table, which shall be done, and which will be the finished curse upon him, so much the better if it is done on this day."
She stood looking at the table as if she stood looking at her own figure lying there. I remained quiet. Estella returned, and she too remained quiet. It seemed to me that we continued thus for a long time. In the heavy air of the room, and the heavy darkness that brooded in its remoter corners, I even had an alarming fancy that Estella and I might presently begin to decay. At length, not coming out of her distraught state by degrees, but in an instant, Miss Havisham said,
"Let me see you two play cards. Why have you not begun?"
With that we returned to her room and sat down as before. I was beggared, as before. and again, as before, Miss Havisham watched us all the time, directed my attention to Estella's beauty, and made me notice it the more by trying her jewels on Estella's breast and hair. Estella, for her part, likewise treated me as before, except that she did not condescend to speak. When we had played some half-dozen games, a day was appointed for my return, and I was taken down into the yard to be fed in the former dog-like manner. There, too, I was again left to wander about as I liked. It is not much to the purpose whether a gate in the garden wall which I had scrambled up to peep over on the last occasion was, on that last occasion, open or shut. Enough that I saw no gate then, and that I saw one now. As it stood open, and as I knew that Estella had let the visitors out, for she had returned with the keys in her hand, I strolled into the garden, and strolled all over it. It was quite a wilderness, and there were old melon frames and cucumber frames in it, which seemed in their decline to have produced a spontaneous growth of weak attempts at pieces of old hats and boots, with now and then a weedy offshoot into the likeness of a battered saucepan. When I had exhausted the garden, and a greenhouse with nothing in it but a fallen-down grapevine and some bottles, I found myself in the dismal corner upon which I had looked out of the window. Never questioning for a moment that the house was now empty, I looked in at another window, and found myself, to my great surprise, exchanging a broad stare with a pale young gentleman with red eyelids and light hair. This pale young gentleman quickly disappeared and reappeared beside me. He had been at his books when I had found myself staring at him, and I now saw that he was inky.
"Hello," said he, "young fellow."
"Hello," being a general observation which I had usually observed to be best answered by itself, I said,
"Hello,"
politely omitting "young fellow."
"Who let you in?"
said he.
"Miss Estella." "Who gave you leave to prowl about?"
"Miss Estella."
"Come and fight,"
said the pale young gentleman. What could I do but follow him? I have often asked myself the question since, but what else could I do? His manner was so final, and I was so astonished, that I followed where he led, as if I had been under a spell.
"Stop a minute, though,"
he said, wheeling round before he had gone many paces.
"I ought to give you a reason for fighting, too. There it is."
In a most irritating manner, he instantly slapped his hands against one another, daintily flung one of his legs up behind him, pulled my hair, slapped his hands again, dipped his head, and butted it into my stomach. The bull-like proceeding last mentioned, besides that it was unquestionably to be regarded in the light of a liberty, was particularly disagreeable just after bread and meat. I therefore hit out at him, and was going to hit out again, when he said,
"Aha! Would you?"
and began dancing backwards and forwards in a manner quite unparalleled within my limited experience.
"Laws of the game,"
said he. Here he skipped from his left leg on to his right.
"Regular rules."
Here he skipped from his right leg on to his left.
"Come to the ground and go through the preliminaries."
Here he dodged backwards and forwards, and did all sorts of things, while I looked helplessly at him. I was secretly afraid of him when I saw him so dexterous. But I felt morally and physically convinced that his light head of hair could have had no business in the pit of my stomach, and that I had a right to consider it irrelevant when so obtruded on my attention. Therefore I followed him without a word to a retired nook of the garden, formed by the junction of two walls and screened by some rubbish. On his asking me if I was satisfied with the ground, and on my replying yes, he begged my leave to absent himself for a moment, and quickly returned with a bottle of water and a sponge dipped in vinegar.
"Available for both,"
he said, placing these against the wall, and then fell to pulling off not only his jacket and waistcoat, but his shirt, too, in a manner at once light-hearted, business-like, and bloodthirsty. Although he did not look very healthy, having pimples on his face and a breaking out at his mouth, these dreadful preparations quite appalled me. I judged him to be about my own age, but he was much taller, and he had a way of spinning himself about that was full of appearance. For the rest, he was a young gentleman in a grey suit, when not denuded for battle, with his elbows, knees, wrists, and heels considerably in advance of the rest of him as to development.
My heart failed me when I saw him squaring at me with every demonstration of mechanical nicety, and eyeing my anatomy as if he were minutely choosing his bone. I never have been so surprised in my life as I was when I let out the first blow, and saw him lying on his back, looking up at me with a bloody nose and his face exceedingly foreshortened. But he was on his feet directly, and after sponging himself with a great show of dexterity, began squaring again. The second greatest surprise I have ever had in my life was seeing him on his back again, looking up at me out of a black eye. His spirit inspired me with great respect. He seemed to have no strength, and he never once hit me hard, and he was always knocked down. But he would be up again in a moment, sponging himself or drinking out of the water bottle, with the greatest satisfaction in seconding himself according to form, and then came at me with an air and a show that made me believe he really was going to do for me at last. He got heavily bruised, for I am sorry to record that the more I hit him, the harder I hit him. But he came up again, and again, and again, until at last he got a bad fall with the back of his head against the wall. Even after that crisis in our affairs, he got up, and turned round and round confusedly a few times, not knowing where I was, but finally went on his knees to his sponge and threw it up, at the same time panting out, "That means you have won!" He seemed so brave and innocent that, although I had not proposed the contest, I felt but a gloomy satisfaction in my victory. Indeed, I go so far as to hope that I regarded myself while dressing as a species of savage young wolf or other wild beast. However, I got dressed, darkly wiping my sanguinary face at intervals, and I said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "No, thank ye." And I said, "Good afternoon." And he said, "Same to you." When I got into the courtyard, I found Estella waiting with the keys. But she neither asked me where I had been nor why I had kept her waiting. And there was a bright flush upon her face, as though something had happened to delight her. Instead of going straight to the gate, too, she stepped back into the passage and beckoned me.
"Come here. You may kiss me if you like."
I kissed her cheek as she turned it to me. I think I would have gone through a great deal to kiss her cheek. But I felt that the kiss was given to the coarse common boy as a piece of money might have been, and that it was worth nothing. What with the birthday visitors, and what with the cards, and what with the fight, my stay had lasted so long that when I neared home the light on the spit of sand off the point on the marshes was gleaming against a black night sky, and Joe's furnace was flinging a path of fire across the road. Chapter 12. My mind grew very uneasy on the subject of the pale young gentleman. The more I thought of the fight, and recalled the pale young gentleman on his back in various stages of puffy and incrimsoned countenance, the more certain it appeared that something would be done to me. I felt that the pale young gentleman's blood was on my head, and that the law would avenge it. Without having any definite idea of the penalties I had incurred, it was clear to me that village boys could not go stalking about the country, ravaging the houses of gentlefolks, and pitching into the studious youth of England without laying themselves open to severe punishment. For some days I even kept close at home, and looked out at the kitchen door with the greatest caution and trepidation before going on an errand, lest the officers of the county jail should pounce upon me. The pale young gentleman's nose had stained my trousers, and I tried to wash out that evidence of my guilt in the dead of night. I had cut my knuckles against the pale young gentleman's teeth, and I twisted my imagination into a thousand tangles as I devised incredible ways of accounting for that damnatory circumstance when I should be haled before the judges. When the day came round for my return to the scene of the deed of violence, my terrors reached their height. Whether myrmidons of justice, specially sent down from London, would be lying in ambush behind the gate? Whether Miss Havisham, preferring to take personal vengeance for an outrage done to her house, might rise in those grave clothes of hers, draw a pistol, and shoot me dead? Whether suborned boys, a numerous band of mercenaries, might be engaged to fall upon me in the brewery and cuff me until I was no more? It was high testimony to my confidence in the spirit of the pale young gentleman that I never imagined him accessory to these retaliations. They always came into my mind as the acts of injudicious relatives of his, goaded on by the state of his visage and an indignant sympathy with the family features. However, go to Miss Havisham's I must, and go I did. And behold, nothing came of the late struggle. It was not alluded to in any way, and no pale young gentleman was to be discovered on the premises. I found the same gate open, and I explored the garden, and even looked in at the windows of the detached house. But my view was suddenly stopped by the closed shutters within, and all was lifeless. Only in the corner where the combat had taken place could I detect any evidence of the young gentleman's existence. There were traces of his gore in that spot, and I covered them with garden mould from the eye of man. On the broad landing between Miss Havisham's own room and that other room in which the long table was laid out, I saw a garden chair, a light chair on wheels that you pushed from behind. It had been placed there since my last visit, and I entered that same day on a regular occupation of pushing Miss Havisham in this chair, when she was tired of walking with her hand upon my shoulder, round her own room, and across the landing, and round the other room. Over and over, and over again, we would make these journeys, and sometimes they would last as long as 3 hours at a stretch. I insensibly fall into a general mention of these journeys as numerous, because it was at once settled that I should return every alternate day at noon for these purposes, and because I am now going to sum up a period of at least 8 or 10 months. As we began to be more used to one another, Miss Havisham talked more to me, and asked me such questions as what had I learnt, and what was I going to be. I told her I was going to be apprenticed to Joe, I believed. And I enlarged upon my knowing nothing, and wanting to know everything, in the hope that she might offer some help towards that desirable end. But she did not. On the contrary, she seemed to prefer my being ignorant. Neither did she ever give me any money, or anything but my daily dinner, nor ever stipulate that I should be paid for my services. Estella was always about, and always let me in and out, but never told me I might kiss her again. Sometimes she would coldly tolerate me. Sometimes she would condescend to me. Sometimes she would be quite familiar with me. Sometimes she would tell me energetically that she hated me. Miss Havisham would often ask me in a whisper, or when we were alone, "Does she grow prettier and prettier, Pip?" And when I said yes, for indeed she did, would seem to enjoy it greedily. Also, when we played at cards, Miss Havisham would look on with a miserly relish of Estella's moods, whatever they were. And sometimes, when her moods were so many and so contradictory of one another that I was puzzled what to say or do, Miss Havisham would embrace her with lavish fondness, murmuring something in her ear that sounded like, "Break their hearts, my pride and hope. Break their hearts and have no mercy." There was a song Joe used to hum fragments of at the forge, of which the burden was "Old Clem." This was not a very ceremonious way of rendering homage to a patron saint, but I believe "Old Clem" stood in that relation towards Smith's. It was a song that imitated the measure of beating upon iron, and was a mere lyrical excuse for the introduction of Old Clem's respected name. Thus you were to hammer boys round, Old Clem, with a thump and a sound, Old Clem. Beat it out, Old Clem, with a clink for the stout, Old Clem. Blow the fire, Old Clem. Roaring drier, soaring higher, Old Clem. One day, soon after the appearance of the chair, Miss Havisham suddenly saying to me with the impatient movement of her fingers, "There, there, there! Sing!" I was surprised into crooning this ditty as I pushed her over the floor. It happened so to catch her fancy that she took it up in a low, brooding voice as if she were singing in her sleep. After that it became customary with us to have it as we moved about, and Estella would often join in, though the whole strain was so subdued, even when there were three of us, that it made less noise in the grim old house than the lightest breath of wind. What could I become with these surroundings? How could my character fail to be influenced by them? Is it to be wondered at if my thoughts were dazed, as my eyes were when I came out into the natural light from the misty yellow rooms? Perhaps I might have told Joe about the pale young gentleman if I had not previously been betrayed into those enormous inventions to which I had confessed. Under the circumstances, I felt that Joe could hardly fail to discern in the pale young gentleman an appropriate passenger to be put into the black velvet coach. Therefore, I said nothing of him. Besides, that shrinking from having Miss Havisham and Estella discussed, which had come upon me in the beginning, grew much more potent as time went on. I reposed complete confidence in no one but Biddy. But I told poor Biddy everything. Why it came natural to me to do so, and why Biddy had a deep concern in everything I told her, I did not know then, though I think I know now. Meanwhile, councils went on in the kitchen at home, fraught with almost insupportable aggravation to my exasperated spirit. That ass Pumblechook used often to come over of a night for the purpose of discussing my prospects with my sister. And I really do believe, to this hour with less penitence than I ought to feel, that if these hands could have taken a linchpin out of his chaise cart, they would have done it. The miserable man was a man of that confined stolidity of mind that he could not discuss my prospects without having me before him, as it were, to operate upon, and he would drag me up from my stool, usually by the collar, where I was quiet in a corner, and putting me before the fire as if I were going to be cooked, would begin by saying,
"Now, mum, here is the boy. Here is the boy which you brought up by hand. Hold up your head, boy, and be forever grateful unto them which so did do. Now, mum, with respections to this boy."
And then he would rumple my hair the wrong way, which from my earliest remembrance, as already hinted, I have in my soul denied the right of any fellow creature to do, and would hold me before him by the sleeve, a spectacle of imbecility only to be equalled by himself. Then he and my sister would pair off in such nonsensical speculations about Miss Havisham, and about what she would do with me and for me, that I used to want, quite painfully, to burst into spiteful tears, fly at Pumblechook, and pummel him all over. In these dialogues my sister spoke to me as if she were morally wrenching one of my teeth out at every reference, while Pumblechook himself, self-constituted my patron, would sit supervising me with a depreciatory eye, like the architect of my fortunes who thought himself engaged on a very unremunerative job. In these discussions, Joe bore no part, but he was often talked at while they were in progress, by reason of Mrs. Joe's perceiving that he was not favourable to my being taken from the forge. I was fully old enough now to be apprenticed to Joe, and when Joe sat with a poker on his knees thoughtfully raking out the ashes between the lower bars, my sister would so distinctly construe that innocent action into opposition on his part that she would dive at him, take the poker out of his hands, shake him, and put it away. There was a most irritating end to every one of these debates. All in a moment, with nothing to lead up to it, my sister would stop herself in a yawn, and, catching sight of me, as it were incidentally, would swoop upon me with,
"Come, there's enough of you. You get along to bed. You've given trouble enough for one night, I hope."
As if I had besought them as a favour to bother my life out. We went on in this way for a long time, and it seemed likely that we should continue to go in this way for a long time when, one day, Miss Havisham stopped short as she and I were walking, she leaning on my shoulder, and said with some displeasure,
"You are growing tall, Pip."
I thought it best to hint, through the medium of a meditative look, this might be occasioned by circumstances over which I had no control. She said no more at the time, but she presently stopped and looked at me again, and presently again, and after that looked frowning and moody. On the next day of my attendance, when our usual exercise was over and I had landed her at her dressing-table, she stayed me with a movement of her impatient fingers.
"Tell me the name again of that blacksmith of yours."
"Joe Gargery, ma'am."
"Meaning the master you were to be apprenticed to?"
"Yes, Miss Havisham."
"You had better be apprenticed at once. Would Gargery come here with you and bring your indentures, do you think?"
I signified that I had no doubt he would take it as an honour to be asked.
"Then let him come."
"At any particular time, Miss Havisham?"
"There, there. I know nothing about times. Let him come soon, and come along with you."
When I got home at night and delivered this message for Joe, my sister went on the rampage in a more alarming degree than at any previous period. She asked me and Joe whether we supposed she was doormats under our feet, and how we dared to use her so, and what company we graciously thought she was fit for. When she had exhausted a torrent of such inquiries, she threw a candlestick at Joe, burst into a loud sobbing, got out the dustpan, which was always a very bad sign, put on her coarse apron and began cleaning up to a terrible extent. Not satisfied with a dry cleaning, she took to a pail and scrubbing brush, and cleaned us out of house and home so that we stood shivering in the backyard. It was 10 o'clock at night before we ventured to creep in again. And then she asked Joe why he hadn't married a negress slave at once. Joe offered no answer, poor fellow, but stood feeling his whisker and looking dejectedly at me, as if he thought it really might have been a better speculation. Chapter 13. It was a trial to my feelings on the next day but one to see Joe arraying himself in his Sunday clothes to accompany me to Miss Havisham's. However, as he thought his court suit necessary to the occasion, it was not for me to tell him that he looked far better in his working dress. The rather, because I knew he made himself so dreadfully uncomfortable, entirely on my account, and that it was for me he pulled up his shirt collar so very high behind that it made the hair on the crown of his head stand up like a tuft of feathers. At breakfast time my sister declared her intention of going to town with us, and being left at Uncle Pumblechook's, and called for, "when we had done with our fine ladies," a way of putting the case, for which Joe appeared inclined to augur the worst. The forge was shut up for the day, and Joe inscribed in chalk upon the door, as it was his custom to do on the very rare occasions when he was not at work, the monosyllable "Hout," accompanied by a sketch of an arrow supposed to be flying in the direction he had taken. We walked to town, my sister leading the way in a very large beaver bonnet, and carrying a basket like the Great Seal of England in plaited straw, a pair of pattens, a spare shawl, and an umbrella, though it was a fine, bright day. I'm not quite clear whether these articles were carried penitentially or ostentatiously, but I rather think they were displayed as articles of property, much as Cleopatra or any other sovereign lady on the rampage might exhibit her wealth in a pageant or procession. When we came to Pumblechook's, my sister bounced in and left us. As it was almost noon, Joe and I held straight on to Miss Havisham's house. Estella opened the gate as usual, and the moment she appeared, Joe took his hat off, and stood weighing it by the brim in both his hands, as if he had some urgent reason in his mind for being particular to half a quarter of an ounce. Estella took no notice of either of us, but led us the way that I knew so well. I followed next to her, and Joe came last. When I looked back at Joe in the long passage, he was still weighing his hat with the greatest care, and was coming after us in long strides on the tips of his toes. Estella told me we were both to go in, so I took Joe by the coat cuff and conducted him into Miss Havisham's presence. She was seated at her dressing-table and looked round at us immediately.
"Oh," said she to Joe, "you are the husband of the sister of this boy?"
I could hardly have imagined dear old Joe looking so unlike himself, or so like some extraordinary bird, standing as he did, speechless, with his tuft of feathers ruffled, and his mouth open, as if he wanted a worm.
"You are the husband," repeated Miss Havisham, "of the sister of this boy?"
It was very aggravating. But throughout the interview, Joe persisted in addressing me, instead of Miss Havisham.
"Which I mean to say, Pip,"
Joe now observed, in a manner that was at once expressive of forcible argumentation, strict confidence, and great politeness,
"as I happen married your sister, and I were at the time what you might call, if you was anyways inclined, a single man."
"Well," said Miss Havisham, "and you have reared the boy with the intention of taking him for your apprentice. Is that so, Mr. Gargery?"
"You know, Pip," replied Joe, "as you and me were ever friends, and it were looked forward to betwixt us as being calculated to lead to larks. Not but what, Pip, if you had ever made objections to the business, such as its being open to black and soot, or such like,
Not but what they would have been attended to, don't you see?
Has the boy, said Miss Havisham, ever made an objection? Does he like the trade?
Which it is will be known to yourself, Pip,
returned Joe, strengthening his former mixture of argumentation, confidence, and politeness,
that it were the wish of your own heart.
I saw the idea suddenly break upon him that he would adapt his epitaph to the occasion, before he went on to say,
And there weren't no objection on your part, and, Pip, it were the great wish of your heart.
It was quite in vain for me to endeavour to make him sensible that he ought to speak to Miss Havisham. The more I made faces and gestures to him to do it, the more confidential, argumentative, and polite he persisted in being to me.
"Have you brought his indentures with you?"
asked Miss Havisham.
"Well, Pip, you know,"
replied Joe, as if that were a little unreasonable.
"You yourself see me put them in my hat, and therefore you know as they are here."
With which he took them out, and gave them not to Miss Havisham, but to me. I am afraid I was ashamed of the dear good fellow. I know I was ashamed of him. When I saw that Estella stood at the back of Miss Havisham's chair, and that her eyes laughed mischievously, I took the indentures out of his hand and gave them to Miss Havisham.
"You expected," said Miss Havisham as she looked them over, "no premium with the boy?"
"Joe," I remonstrated, for he made no reply at all.
"Why don't you answer?"
"Pip," returned Joe, cutting me short as if he were hurt.
"Which I mean to say that were not a question requiring an answer betwixt yourself and me, and which you know the answer to be full well no. You know it to be no, Pip, and wherefore should I say it?"
Miss Havisham glanced at him as if she understood what he really was, better than I had thought possible, seeing what he was there, and took up a little bag from the table beside her.
"Pip has earned a premium here," she said, "and here it is. There are 25 guineas in this bag. Give it to your master, Pip."
As if he were absolutely out of his mind with the wonder awakened in him by her strange figure and the strange room, Joe, even at this pass, persisted in addressing me.
"That is very liberal on your part, Pip," said Joe, "and it is as such received and grateful welcome, though never looked for, far nor near nor nowheres. And now, old chap," said Joe,
conveying to me a sensation first of burning and then of freezing, for I felt as if that familiar expression were applied to Miss Havisham,
"and now, old chap, may we do our duty. May you and me do our duty, both on us by one and another, and by them which your liberal present have conveyed to be, for the satisfaction of mind of them as never..."
Here Joe showed that he felt he had fallen into frightful difficulties, and he triumphantly rescued himself with the words,
"And from myself far be it."
These words had such a round and convincing sound for him that he said them twice.
"Good-bye, Pip," said Miss Havisham. "Let them out, Estella."
"Am I to come again, Miss Havisham?"
I asked.
"No. Gargery is your master now. Gargery."
"One word." Thus calling him back as I went out of the door, I heard her say to Joe, in a distinct, emphatic voice,
"The boy has been a good boy here, and that is his reward. Of course, as an honest man, you will expect no other and no more."
How Joe got out of the room, I have never been able to determine. But I know that when he did get out, he was steadily proceeding upstairs instead of coming down, and was deaf to all remonstrances until I went after him and laid hold of him. In another minute we were outside the gate, and it was locked, and Estella was gone. When we stood in the daylight alone again, Joe backed up against the wall and said to me,
"Astonishing!"
And there he remained so long, saying, "Astonishing!" at intervals so often, that I began to think his senses were never coming back. At length he prolonged his remark into,
"Pip, I do assure you this is astonishing!"
And so, by degrees, became conversational and able to walk away. I have reason to think that Joe's intellects were brightened by the encounter they had passed through, and that on our way to Pumblechook's he invented a subtle and deep design. My reason is to be found in what took place in Mr. Pumblechook's parlour, where, on our presenting ourselves, my sister sat in conference with that detested seedsman.
"Well?"
cried my sister, addressing us both at once.
"And what's happened to you? I wonder you condescend to come back to such poor society as this. I am sure I do."
"Miss Havisham," said Joe, with a fixed look at me, with an effort of remembrance, "made it very particular that we should give her—" "Were it compliments or respects, Pip?"
"Compliments," I said.
"Which that were my own belief," answered Joe.
"Her compliments to Mrs. J. Gargery."
"Much good thou do me,"
observed my sister, but rather gratified too.
"And wishing," pursued Joe, with another fixed look at me, like another effort of remembrance, "that the state of Miss Havisham's health were such as would have allowed, were it, Pip?"
"Of her having the pleasure," I added.
"Of ladies' company," said Joe, and drew a long breath.
"Well,"
cried my sister, with a mollified glance at Mr. Pumblechook,
"she might have had the politeness to send that message at first, but it's better late than never. And what does she give young Rantipole here?"
"She give him," said Joe, "nothing."
Mrs. Joe was going to break out, but Joe went on.
"What she give," said Joe, "she give to his friends. And by his friends, were her explanation, I mean into the hands of his sister, Mrs. J. Gargery. Them were her words.
Mrs. J. Gargery.
She might have knowed," added Joe, with an appearance of reflection, "whether it were Joe or George."
My sister looked at Pumblechook, who smoothed the elbows of his wooden armchair and nodded at her and at the fire as if he had known all about it beforehand.
"And how much have you got?"
asked my sister, laughing. Positively, laughing.
"What would present company say to £10?
Demanded Joe.
"They say," returned my sister curtly, "pretty well. Not too much, but pretty well." "It's more than that, then," said Joe.
That fearful impostor, Pumblechook, immediately nodded and said as he rubbed the arms of his chair,
"It's more than that, mum."
"Why, you don't mean to say—" began my sister.
"Yes, I do, mum," said Pumblechook. "But wait a bit. Go on, Joseph. Good in you. Go on."
"What would present company say," proceeded Joe, "to £20?
"Handsome would be the word," returned my sister.
"Well then," said Joe, "it's more than £20.
That abject hypocrite Pumblechook nodded again, and said with a patronizing laugh,
"It's more than that, mum. Good again. Follow her up, Joseph."
"Then, to make an end of it,"
said Joe, delightedly handing the bag to my sister,
"it's £25.
"It's £25, mum,"
echoed that basest of swindlers, Pumblechook, rising to shake hands with her.
"And it's no more than your merits, as I said when my opinion was asked, and I wish you joy of the money."
If the villain had stopped here, his case would have been sufficiently awful, but he blackened his guilt by proceeding to take me into custody with a right of patronage that left all his former criminality far behind.
"Now you see, Joseph and wife,"
said Pumblechook, as he took me by the arm above the elbow,
"I am one of them that always go right through with what they've begun. This boy must be bound out of hand. That's my way. Bound out of hand."
"Goodness knows, Uncle Pumblechook,"
said my sister, grasping the money, "we're deeply beholden to you."
"Never mind me, mum,"
returned that diabolical corn chandler.
"A pleasure's a pleasure all the world over. But this boy, you know, we must have him bound. I said I'd see to it, to tell you the truth."
The justices were sitting in the town hall near at hand, and we at once went over to have me bound apprentice to Joe in the magisterial presence. I say we went over, but I was pushed over by Pumblechook, exactly as if I had that moment picked a pocket or fired a rick. Indeed, it was the general impression in court that I had been taken red-handed, for as Pumblechook shoved me before him through the crowd, I heard some people say, "What's he done?"
And others, "He's a young un too, but looks bad, don't he?" One person of mild and benevolent aspect even gave me a tract, ornamented with a woodcut, of a malevolent young man fitted up with a perfect sausage-chopper fetters and entitled "To Be Read in My Cell." The hall was a queer place, I thought, with higher pews in it than a church, and with people hanging over the pews looking on, and with mighty justices, one with a powdered head, leaning back in chairs with folded arms, or taking snuff, or going to sleep, or writing, or reading the newspapers, and with some shining black portraits on the walls which my unartistic eye regarded as a composition of hardbake and sticking plaster. Here, in a corner, my indentures were duly signed and attested, and I was bound, Mr. Pumblechook holding me all the while as if we had looked in on our way to the scaffold to have those little preliminaries disposed of. When we had come out again, and had got rid of the boys who had been put into great spirits by the expectation of seeing me publicly tortured, and who were much disappointed to find that my friends were merely rallying round me, we went back to Pumblechook's. And there my sister became so excited by the 25 guineas that nothing would serve her but we must have a dinner out of that windfall at the Blue Boar, and that Pumblechook must go over in his chaise cart and bring the Hubbles and Mr. Wopsle. It was agreed to be done, and a most melancholy day I passed. For it inscrutably appeared to stand to reason in the minds of the whole company that I was an excrescence on the entertainment. And to make it worse, they all asked me from time to time, in short, whenever they had nothing else to do, why I didn't enjoy myself. And what could I possibly do then but say I was enjoying myself, when I wasn't? However, they were grown up, and had their own way, and they made the most of it. That swindling Pumblechook, exalted into the beneficent contriver of the whole occasion, actually took the top of the table. And when he addressed them on the subject of my being bound, and had fiendishly congratulated them on my being liable to imprisonment if I played at cards, drank strong liquors, kept late hours or bad company, or indulged in other vagaries which the form of my indentures appeared to contemplate as next to inevitable, he placed me standing on a chair beside him, to illustrate his remarks. My only other remembrances of the great festival are that they wouldn't let me go to sleep, but whenever they saw me dropping off, woke me up and told me to enjoy myself. That rather late in the evening Mr. Wopsle gave us Collins's ode and threw his blood-stained sword in thunder down with such effect that a waiter came in and said, "The commercials underneath sent up their compliments and it wasn't the Tumbler's Arms." That they were all in excellent spirits on the road home and sang "O Lady Fair," Mr. Wopsle taking the bass and asserting with a tremendously strong voice, in reply to the inquisitive bore who leads that piece of music in a most impertinent manner, by wanting to know all about everybody's private affairs, that he was the man with his white locks flowing, and that he was upon the whole the weakest pilgrim going. Finally, I remember that when I got into my little bedroom I was truly wretched, and had a strong conviction on me that I should never like Joe's trade. I had liked it once, but once was not now.